So hello and welcome to our very first live episode of the Rabbit Hole Detectives at the beautiful Royal Theatre in Northampton. Yay. This is a podcast where I, Dr. Kat Jarman, Richard Coles, and Charles Spencer chase the provenance of historical objects, both real and metaphorical. Each episode, we set one another the task of finding out as much as we possibly can about a particular subject to present a comprehensive understanding of the origin stories of stuff. After all, everything has a history. It just depends on how far down the rabbit hole you're prepared to go. And at the end of it all, our disembodied voice normally pronounces a winner. But this week, because we have a live audience, they are going to choose for us. Fine. So, hello, rabbit hollows.
Hello, Kat.
Hello, Kat.
Everyone excited?
Well, it's thrilling, actually. I mean, it's particularly for Richard and me to be in home territory. And no, it's great. And I know what the topics are because they were announced last week. We've all gone Northampton-ish, but not Northampton mad.
I think it'd be a very good idea.
Should we just get going?
Do you want to kick me off?
Yes. So you're going to be starting this week, Charles, and you're going to be talking about Thomas Becket, and you have to explain the Northampton link.
Well, if you go past Halfords on the way out of Northampton, opposite is the Thomas Becket pub. And that is not just a random name from the past, but the name of a man very much associated with this town. But I want to actually spread, so as normal, go down a lot of rabbit holes, a lot of different directions. And I'm going to kick off with a year that's very familiar to me, which is 1120. And that was the year when the white ship sank, the Titanic of the Middle Ages, and essentially half the royal family, the great administrators, generals, courtiers of England, all went down in a tragic shipping accident off the Normandy coast in 1120. I suppose it led very soon, actually, to the end of the Norman dynasty and the start of the Plantagenets. And the Plantagenets then ended up ruling England from the middle of the 12th century until Henry VII took over, the Tudors took over in 1485. So it was a bit of a shipwreck with fatal results. But at the same time, 1120 is when Thomas Becket is born, and he was the serious problem for the first Plantagenet, and that is Henry II. Henry II, I want to set the scene. I mean, the Plantagenets were known for having a bit of a temper, and Henry II was believed to be descended from the daughter of the devil, because his was particularly bad.
My DNA was bad.
And basically, he was this incredibly restless, energetic figure. And people used to see him hardly ever sit down at all. Just, you know, even when he was doing his religious services, sitting there, he'd be weaving the holes out of hunting garments or his soldier's gear. He couldn't just sit still. And there's even a story about when somebody complimented William the Lion, who was King of Scotland, Henry II was so angry that he ripped his bedclothes and ate the contents of his mattress. Mm. So this is a man with a shortish fuse. And that's really where it comes into the Becket thing. It's not just a gratuitous rabbit hole. And Thomas Becket was a fairly sort of humble, a merchant stock, born in Cheapside in London. His father was a sheriff of London. But he had real ability, and he shot up the sort of administrative centre of Henry II's court and became eventually chancellor, basically the equivalent of a prime minister, running the place for Henry. And Henry and him got on very well. They were both quite laddish. They enjoyed hunting and cavorting and all sorts of things. And Henry thought, well, this is the perfect man to be Archbishop of Canterbury. And so he made him the primate of all England. And then, to total astonishment to Henry II, Thomas Becket became religious. This was not expected or required.
It's not really part of the job description.
Not really.
But he went native.
Well, yes. You see, Henry II's plan was, there was a lot of tension between the crown and the church back then. And Henry II wanted to sort that out and make sure that the crown was in charge. And when Thomas Becket became a very difficult archbishop, he was summoned to Northampton. There used to be a very important medieval castle here, where the station is now, the railway station. In fact, that used to be called Northampton Castle Station, as some of you all know. All sorts of problems when they met. They decided to meet outside the town on what is now called Becket's Park, and they were each on a horse and the horses didn't like each other. They reared up and it was a very complicated, shouty conversation for an hour where they decided they didn't like each other. And then after that, we have this trial in Northampton of Becket, and it becomes very clear that Henry II has famously lost his temper and has decided that his friend, who's betrayed him, is going to have to pay with his life. Becket flees, goes to France, gets the Pope on side, and then in 1170 comes back in a sort of surprise move, really. And there is this moment, I bet you know the famous quote that is meant to be attached to this.
It's on the tip of my tongue.
Henry II...
Well, there's a dispute about this, isn't
it? Yes, there is.
It was a troublesome upstart.
Henry II's meant to have said, he's meant to have summoned his court and said, Becket's back. That bit's me improvising. And then the famous quote is, who will rid me of this troublesome priest? He didn't actually say that. We know from the accounts. What's interesting about this whole episode with Becket is how many accounts there were, because, spoiler alert, he's going to die. After his death, there were 20 biographies written about him straight away. And essentially, you end up with this, well, a challenge to, if you want to be in favour with the angry Henry II, you have to do something about it. And four knights go to Canterbury and find Becket there. And one of the knights holds everyone away from what's going to happen, and the other three kill Becket. And he dies not only as a sort of martyr to the church, but also incredibly bravely. He kneels down and accepts what's about to happen to him.
Charles, people who know this podcast will expect you to go into much more gory detail. Yes. That's
a mild version, come on.
So talk us through the end of Becket.
I can.
Vivid account.
Well, there is a vivid account. The first stroke took the top of his head off and he was still talking. So it was very unfortunate. And it only got worse, actually. And somebody hit him so hard with their sword that it broke. So you have to think, goodness, that must have been quite painful. And so he then dies. And the monks, I know you won't believe this, Richard, being a man of the cloth, but the monks think, we can make money out of this. And they mix his blood in water and sell it in little bottles to pilgrims. And very quickly, there's this cult of St. Thomas. Within 2.5 years, very quick for a canonization, Thomas Becket becomes a saint.
Interesting discussion there would have been at the point at which the community realised that they could monetize this.
Yes.
Because the doctrine of relics is that one atom is all you need for the full sanctity of the venerated person to inhere. So you could dilute and dilute and dilute and dilute.
Oh, yeah, no, the good monks of Canterbury, they went for it. And they they even venerated the broken sword, which I think is not really the point, is it?
What about the knights? What happened to them? Do we know about them?
Oh, the knights, yes. So there were four of them. The lead one was a man called Fitz Urse. They thought they'd done a great thing and they were going to be rewarded. It became quite clear very early on that the Pope was very angry and all sorts of people really thought that this was beyond the pale to kill the Archbishop of Canterbury in his cathedral. So they went and waited to see what would happen. They waited for a year in Knaresborough. The 12th century was a slowish century. So they waited for a year and then they asked what were they meant to do. Henry, by this stage, completely backtracks, sort of pretending he hadn't had anything to do with it, disinherited all their sons, which was a big deal in medieval knighthood circles. And they eventually went to the Pope and asked for forgiveness. And the Pope said, well, the only way you're going to earn forgiveness is go on a pilgrimage to the Holy Land. And all we know is that they did go there, but they seem to all have perished either on the way to Jerusalem or when they got there.
Don't mess with the Archbishop of Canterbury.
And then Henry II realised he still had to do something. He fell out with his family very badly. His wife, Eleanor of Aquitaine, she sided with three of her sons against him just 3 years after Becket's death. He imprisoned her for 16 years. I mean, these medieval kings weren't really for messing around. So he put her in a prison. He was losing his war against his sons. And he went to Canterbury, walked barefoot through the city, and pleaded for forgiveness. And the next day he won this stunning battle. And he, after that, took Thomas Becket as his talisman, his protector?
So many questions. There's something very narratively shaped about all this, isn't there? So the ambiguity of what the king says, will nobody rid me of this troublesome priest? Not saying go and kill Thomas, but kind of over to you, see what you come up with that. Them meeting Sticky End on their crusades, the reconciliation of Henry, and the sort of adoption of Thomas. And so it does sound like a bit of statecraft, doesn't it?
Well, he definitely had run out of patience with him. We know he had wanted to kill him when he was on trial in Northampton.
But do you know what I think? I think it's a bromance that went bad. I mean, this may be say more about me than it does about Beckett. And
yes, it does.
But if you read the accounts, there does seem to be something... That encounter outside the walls of Northampton, fascinating, because you'd think you're not going to stand up to the power of the king, for goodness sake. There's something about Beckett which gives him confidence and poise and a challenge in that, which suggests that there is more than one register to their relationship. It's not simply subject to king. It's their peers. Do you think?
I don't really, but I think... No, I don't, but I think it's to do with a man suddenly finding his vocation. And I think he really passionately believed in Christianity. But I think probably from Henry's point of view, how disappointing. You know, he said, I raised him from the dust and made him the most powerful man in the land. And this is how, he actually said, he's kicked me in the teeth.
But you see, that's emotionally charged, isn't it? This is not just people having a fight at work, is it? There's... Personal investment. Yeah. Do you think that's right? Or is this an ahistorical perspective?
It depends, because it depends a lot on the sources.
I'm not saying they're boyfriends.
No, they might have been. It's more about maybe that's more the sources describing them, and because it's become such an important tale.
Becomes sort of relatable.
Yeah.
Because that kind of soap opera thing about a friendship that was strong, the unexpected rise to power.
Well, it's Wolf Hall again, isn't it? You know, it's Henry VIII. And actually, so... My favourite fact about this is it Thomas Becket or Thomas à Becket? And I didn't know until researching for this, but Thomas à Becket was an insult. So essentially, the Protestants hated this very powerful Catholic martyr, and they had to besmirch his name. So we have Henry VIII ordering a desecration of his bones, because you can't encourage Catholics to stand up against the king. You have to actually discourage them. And then in the late 16th century, so in Elizabethan times, a man called Thomas Nash, who was a satirist, he started to call him à Becket because he was trying to make him as unimportant as some of the Robin Hood, I was about to say Shakespeare, Robin Hood and Shakespeare, not the same. Robin Hood characters, Alan a Dale and the What's It a Green. So à Becket was like... He's almost a mythical nonsense figure. So it was a conscious way of taking down a Catholic martyr.
And because also the power of the throne needs to be not only acknowledged but displayed, doesn't it? So challenge, and that's built into it, because the power of the papacy, the claims you'd have to the kingdom beyond this world is always going to conflict with the kingdom of this world, right?
Well, I think that's true, but the global impact...
I think you've not really gone into the bromance angle.
No, that's the more interesting one, isn't it?
But the impact, global impact of this was so huge. Well, certainly across Europe, this tale of a king killing a man who was standing up for ecclesiastical rights was resonated. And in fact, Kat, in northern Sweden, you know, at the time, when they were building a font in a particular town in Sweden, they had the scene, and they actually have Henry ordering the death of Thomas Becket. So it really was an unbelievably dramatic event.
And he was a hugely, I mean, he was a saint whose glory and renown was venerated all over Christendom with very significant scenes. And the shrine of Thomas Becket at Canterbury was one of the most splendid. There's a famous account of Erasmus going to visit it. Mm. Just thought I'd get that in. Might not be a professional historian, but I've done that.
So is that where he was most popular? Or is he one of those? Do some of the saints become very popular in a very bizarre location, don't they?
Well, absolutely. Well, if you think Chaucer's, the pilgrimage is to go, it's the pilgrimage of Chaucer's tales, is to go and pay your respects to Thomas Becket's tomb.
A holy blissful martyr. Mm. And there is a church dedicated to him now in Sicily, so I think his fame spread far away. And also, if you're the church, if you're the papacy, anyone of your archbishops who stands up to royal power, there's something in that that might serve your needs, right?
Yes.
Yeah. What about the bromance, though, Charles?
I wish I'd had time to prepare something to titillate the vicar.
Maybe this needs a book.
It's the Hollywood version, isn't it? See, I'm not... You're a professional. I'm just a pond skater on the meniscus of culture. So I'm looking for the kind of Hollywood,
the Hollywood moment.
Yeah.
Well, it was The Lion in Winter was based on that, wasn't it? Yeah. And Beckett, of course. So yeah, it's had its moments.
But you have it also, don't you, in the relationship between Thomas More and Henry VIII, or Thomas Cromwell and Henry VIII. Again, it's
over mighty servants.
And yet they sort of need them, don't they? And then they kill them, don't they?
Yeah.
Fear. Yeah. Well, don't get too near to the sun, right?
It's true. So that's
very good.
It's an effort. Yes. I don't know if it was any good, but I did my best.
It's a very good start. Thank you. Right, so me next. And I was going to talk about, I thought I'd go Northampton here, with somebody who probably actually not enough people know enough about. As a woman called Elfgifu of Northampton. How does a woman from Northampton, about 1,000 years ago, become actually queen of two countries and also the mother of two kings?
I don't know.
And then you haven't heard of her.
Do you know, I'm embarrassed to say, Northampton born and bred, I haven't heard of her.
I haven't heard of her.
Has she got like an anglicised version of that name?
That is her anglicised version of
what's the not anglicised?
There's a Scandinavian version, which is Alviva. So that's a little clue to what happens to her. So what do you think? So obviously she's Queen of England at one point. Other country, what might
well,
it be?
Norway.
Yes. So she is from a very wealthy, very powerful family. They actually come from a little bit further north originally. So we don't quite know when the Northampton link comes in and when she becomes called this. Her father was at the court of Ethelred, the Unready. And he was very popular for a while until he did something and got murdered by the king. Her brothers were blinded. This is your territory of gruesomeness, I think. But she was absolutely fine. And then eventually in 1013, the famous event of that year, which is the invasion by Swain Forkbeard of Denmark. So he invades, but he successfully becomes king of England. With him is a young, handsome man called Knut. Yes. And he needs a wife. So Swain decides to find someone who's got a lot of power and settles on Elfgifu. So Knut and Elfgifu marry, political marriage, really. But Swain dies soon afterwards and they have to go back to Denmark. So the story in England sort of continues for a little bit until Knut himself decides to invade and conquer England. So 1016, he's successful and he wins England and becomes king actually for almost 20 years.
Can I just say, that is always so surprising, isn't it? Because we think, most English people think, oh, we were defeated in 1066, not 1016. And it's so odd that we have that huge invasion and we don't even remember it.
It's so called the neglected conquest.
But why do we remember the Norman conquest as the definitive one rather than that?
Because it lasted, I suppose.
Well, I suppose it did, and it had more permanent changes. But this one was actually a really successful, quite relatively peaceful one as well, which is quite an interesting one. Reasonably.
Boring.
Well, except maybe that was it. Too boring. But back to Elfgifu. So this is quite good for a while. They have two children. They've got a son called Swain and a son called Harold, later to be known as Harold Harefoot, which is possibly more familiar. But then when Knut realises he needs a bit more power, he needs a bit more support, he decides he's got to make a clever move. So he actually divorces Elfgifu, and instead he decides to marry his predecessor's widow, Emma of Normandy, who was married to Ethelred the Unready. Ethelred and Emma had several children, and they were all contenders to the throne, and this becomes a big, big issue. So Elfgifu sort of disappears for a little while, until later on, he also becomes king of Denmark. His brother was king of Denmark until 1018. He becomes the king of Denmark. And then the Norwegians and the Swedes decide to try and attack Denmark, which is a really bad idea. They didn't do a very good job of it. So Knut goes, right, okay, and he sends a big fleet to Norway to essentially try and take Norway as well.
When we say big fleet in this period, what do we mean in terms of numbers?
So this was 50 ships.
50 ships.
So how 50 many large Viking ships.
And how many fighting men could you get on them?
They normally have about 60 pairs of oars. Okay. So you have 60 people rowing it, probably fit a few more on there. So we're talking a sizable number. But actually, in fact, they are so Knut's so powerful that the Norwegians just go, okay, fine, you can have it. And the king flees. Puts a man in charge who dies quite soon afterwards. Then he's a bit stuck. He needs someone he can trust to take on this country. So he decides to put his son, Swain, on the throne.
This is Forkbeard.
This is Forkbeard's grandson.
Got it.
No.
There's going to be a test on the family trees.
I'm going to want some family trees drawn, actually, with all the names properly spelled. The problem is that Swain is 15. So to send a 15-year-old on his own to rule a foreign country where everyone hates him is not a great idea. So what do you do? Well, you send his mother. So that's when Elf Khifu comes along.
I see.
So she is sent to Norway and essentially becomes queen because Swain, for some reason, seems to be really useless. He doesn't really do anything. And she rules the country for 4 years. Very unpopular in all the records. Everyone has a lot of bad things to say about her. Apparently, she was very, there was very heavy taxation. They complain, a sort of cost of living crisis, basically, in Elf Khifu's time. So people have to eat, apparently, animal fodder and all of that. But for 4 years, they're quite successful. So she manages to rule with her son.
You don't always get a break, do you? I mean, is it, if you're ruling in a time of plenty and peace, then that's kind of read into your reign, isn't it? Whereas sometimes it's tougher.
The whole idea at this time was to give your people peace, wasn't it? You would subscribe to a really quite vicious leader as long as you were left alone. That was the idea.
I think that's definitely a big part of it. And also, we don't know what's happened. There could be environmental problems, climate issues, anything like that could happen as well. But actually, I think a lot of Islam, if you look at all the sources, Elf Khifu's got a really bad reputation wherever she goes, really, because it's always the enemies. There's always somebody else writing about her. So that's kind of all we know. So she's called, she's in the sagas, Icelandic sagas, as Alviva, this Scandinavian version of her name.
I've got a question.
Yes.
The Normans were Vikings, right?
They were. Through, and also Emma of Normandy has got a big link. So William, so she was the great aunt or great great aunt, I can't remember, of William the Conqueror. So he actually uses Emma as his link, part of his claim to taking England, because he's got somebody who was the queen.
So basically everything is Vikings.
Because they were Vikings, yes. Norman was literally the Northmen.
So. Well, that's so interesting, isn't it? Because we think of them, don't we? And in an English historical imagination, we think of the French as our eternal enemy. We associate that with a kind of fairly modern idea of what Frenchness is, but they were actually Vikings.
Yes, and Emma spoke Danish as well, because she had a Danish mother. So again,
here's my question.
Language.
So the Vikings get everywhere, as far as America, right?
Yeah.
They conquer everywhere. London was a Viking city.
Yes,
London,
it was.
All this kind of stuff. Why? Well, was it the search? Was it because their natural resources are insufficient? Is there something in their culture that makes conquest irresistible?
That's one of the million-pound questions, really. We don't quite know. It seems to be a combination of that. So there's lots of pressures at home, not enough land, not enough food, all of that. There's all these pools as well as riches everywhere. But it seems to be very much a mentality of exploring and of going places. And that gets social value back home as well. So to have been almost like going, I see these sort of Viking bands as these young men going on a gap year trip, basically.
It was a gap year with rape and pillage, isn't it?
Whereas all the rage in age 15.
It's only inter-rail. It depends where you go.
Closest on the ship.
But it just seems, because you obviously have that heritage. I mean, it's physically, Charles, you've got that. And of course, Northamptonshire didn't the line of the Dane...
It's straight Dane through here, wasn't it?
It's very near, but you're right on the edge here, so they kind of push down.
But that's, I mean, Northamptonshire is one of the rare counties where you get a lot of Anglo-Saxon and a lot of Viking names in one area, because usually it was cut in two, wasn't it?
Yeah.
We'll never know, will we? 89% Kettering, where I get no Viking, nothing at all.
Well, unless that includes the Vikings, so that's done.
Don't think so. But it would show up, wouldn't it? I get it. They show you a little map.
They compare it to...
Blobs. Oh, mine's just got one intense blob, literally, on Wicksteed Park, essentially.
It's your mecca.
Going back to the dinosaurs,
basically. So before we move on, I think we've got our disembodied voice. Oh. I feel like the disembodied voice has a comment for us.
Indeed. Just because I'm not declaring the winner this week doesn't mean I'm not always listening. So... I have a couple of things to add. The first is, yes, Emma of Normandy was the great aunt of William the Conqueror. That was correct. Also, accounts of Henry II claiming Becket was a turbulent priest as well as troublesome. Some people might be more familiar with that, though again, it's likely he didn't say this at all. And before we get into Richard's section, I will vouch for the other rabbit hole is that he will try and butter up the decision makers. So watch yourselves.
It's shameless, isn't it, really?
Give the people what they want, Charles. Is it me now?
It is you, and you're definitely keeping it local.
Well,
thank you. So you're keeping it local as well, because you've been doing your homework researching the Northamptonshire boot and shoe industry.
Indeed I have. Ladies and gentlemen, step with me in your beautifully shod feet out of the Royal, turn right up the Guildhall, turn right again down the Derngate, head down the road. What do you get on the other side of the street? The Barrett Maternity Home. Put up your hand, folks, if you were born in the Barrett. There you go. The Barrett Maternity Home. Now, you probably don't know.
No.
You weren't born in Northampton, were you, Charles?
No, my sister Sarah was born in the Barrett.
The Barrett. So the Barrett Maternity Home was the gift to Northamptonshire and the town by William Barrett, who was one of the great shoe barons of his day. Typically of the shoe barons of his day, he was not only an extraordinarily energetic and enterprising person, but he was also actually very much committed to the common weal, as it were, and to bringing benefits that he made through industry, sharing the fruits of that with the county in a maternity home in an era of high mortality. Mortality was a very important thing, so lots of us were born there. But what is shoemaking and bootmaking doing in Northamptonshire? Well, how far back do we have to go? Well, we can go back to the Middle Ages, around your period, when we know that there were cordwainers who were in Northampton. So cordwainers, shoemakers, comes from Cordoba, they think, which is a source of leather. But the reason why the industry got so settled in this part of the world was threefold. The River Nen, not knee. The River Nen, which waters Northamptonshire. Well, if you live in Jimmy's End, you'll know what it means to be watered by the Nen, that's for sure. So there's plentiful water, plentiful oak forest, because the essential ingredient is really oak bark, which was used in tanning. And because of its richly fertile valley, cattle too, for the production of hide. So you have all the raw materials there. Northampton, very important city in the Middle Ages, or town rather, in the Middle Ages. And so industry concentrates there. And so it gets a kind of foothold. And then you see that begin to gain force as we step through it. Step with me, if you will, to the English Civil War. This is one of your periods, Charles. But if you were to step with me in the English Civil War, if you were for Cromwell, you were probably wearing a pair of boots or shoes that were made in Northampton and Northamptonshire. 6,000 pairs we know were made for Cromwell and indeed the new model army in this county. Step with me, if you will, along the towpath of the Grand Union Canals. The canals arrived in Northamptonshire, 1815, around then. So that opened up Northamptonshire, central England, very well placed for trade, connected to all sorts of other places. That's happening too. And it all gets very exciting in the 19th century. In the 1830s, shoes were being made in their tens of thousands, literally their tens of thousands, in this very town. But it was really industrialisation that changed all that process. And that happened due to one of my own ancestors. In fact, my great-great-great-grandfather was a silk weaver from a little village called Desborough, not very far from Kettering. A little shout-out for Desborough there, folks. He was very typical of the time. He was a Victorian. He was born in the 1830s. He was obviously handy. He caught that rising tide of industrialisation, nonconformist religion. He was a Baptist, and also liberal politics. So there was huge social changes happening, and that was energising this newly emerging class of people who had a bit of vision and determination and grit. And he was an inventor. He became a clock repairer, he became a clock maker, and then he invented machines, and some of those machines were part of the either invented or refined machines that were turned shoemaking into an industrial process. Some really key things came along. Isaac Singer, of course, invented the sewing machine. The sewing machine arrived in Northamptonshire in the 19th century, and there were adaptations of that that made it adaptable to be able to sew the leather pieces of a shoe. The construction of a shoe is a complicated... I don't know why I'm telling you this, Kat, but the construction is a complicated thing. There are all sorts of different processes involved in it, and I'm sure there are people here in the audience tonight who either worked in the shoe trade or had family who were in the shoe trade, who worked in the shoe factories that began to proliferate in this time and would know what a skiver was, or a closer was, or a clicker was. When I was born in the Barrett Maternity Home, March the 26th, 1962, do you know what the midwife said to my mother?
No.
She said, "Oh, Mrs. Coles has got clicker's hands." And do you know what a clicker is?
I have no clue.
A clicker was the highest paid job in the shoe factory. It's considered to be the most skilled. The clicker's job was to cut out from a hide the leather shapes that were stitched together to make the upper of a shoe. And as an experienced, it's called clickers, they use these things called clicker knives, which are these round-handled knives with a very curved, sharp blade. And there would be a template, and you would cut round that. And a good clicker, you'd end up with what looked like a piece of lace, actually, because they'd so skillfully got as much shoe as they could out of the hide. Later replaced by the clicking presses, and I can remember those, these kind of big steam presses, and you put these things like pastry cutters on the hide, and you'd have to press these two buttons. Why would you have to press two buttons in order to depress the clicker press? Because if you still had your hand in it,
Charles,
I just needed a bit of gore here for Charles.
Yes, no, thank you.
So that wasn't, so the shoe factories... and so the shoe factories began to develop.
That's clever.
And the industry, and they produced some extraordinary people. Barrett of Barrett's Returned Home was William Barrett, and he was one of the town's most pioneering and most indigenous. He started off working in a shoe shop, actually. He was from Northampton, worked in a shoe shop, went to London, learned a bit, and then started production. And I think one of the most, if Northampton were to have a signature building, well, you'd think of Terry Wogan's Northampton Lighthouse, wouldn't you? The lift testing thing. But actually, I would say the Barrett factory on Kingsthorpe Road, wouldn't you? Do you know what I mean? Yeah. It's one of the most famous shoe factories. An extraordinary thing in neo-Baroque. Barrett was not only interested in turning out lots of shoes, he was interested, as so many of those Victorian men of industry and vision were, in improving the lot of people. So the factories were well ventilated, people were paid properly, you got time off. My own family, who developed a group of shoe companies at that time, I was looking at some photographs the other day.
Sorry, Richard, what were they called? What was your family firm?
Coles Boot and Shoe. Right. So it was very typical. It was based in Burton Latimer, which is a town, a village really, not far from Kettering. And it prospered and grew in this period. And there were factories in Kettering and Findon, indeed, where I was vicar. And very typical. You'd have industrialisation. I'm sure lots of people here would be only too familiar with those kind of ribbons of red brick Victorian terraced housing and a factory at the end of every street. Thousands of people. I mean, in Coles Boot and Shoe Group, we were making, I think, 1 million pairs of shoes a year.
And what was sort of special about those shoes? Was there anything particular that people were looking for?
You remember what Gerald Ratner said about his jewellery?
I can't
I think it would be fair to say that volume production was the aim.
Okay.
I mean, of course, there were different specialisms as well. For example, so there was volume production in Northampton and Kettering. Long Buckby was riding boots. Woolaston was work boots. Interesting throw forward to perhaps the most well-known brand of any piece of Northamptonshire footwear, Doc Martens.
Oh,
work boots were made in Woolaston because that was the thing.
Do you know about Dr. Martens? So I once did a report on Dr. Martens for American television, and there were two men who, Dr. Martens and his colleague, decided to toss a coin as to who was it was going to be named after. And they really missed a trick, because the other one was Dr. Funks. And it's such a better name, you know.
Not quite positive, though,
But interesting is that Woolaston continued to, it was DMs were made in Woolaston until production shifted to the Far East. Although there is production, I'm happy to, the story is one of expansion and then one of fall. So war was an enormous stimulus to production. So in the First World War, Northamptonshire, I think, made 25 million pairs of boots for the troops. Enterprising, I mean, something like Barrett himself, although he was very skillful, managed to provide boots for both sides in the Spanish Civil War and also provide boots for the Finnish army in their fight against Soviet Russians. But the Finns were actually on the side of the Axis powers at the time. So I think there's a certain canniness about the Northamptonshire shoe manufacturers. And it produced enormous wealth. We're not very far from the Guildhall here in Northampton. You talk about Northampton's prestige in the Middle Ages, and you know, its prestige continued, but it was shoe money that really generated so much of what we see in the town today. Faded, of course. What happened was in the 1970s and then in the 80s, cheap imports. So those boots and shoes that were made in enormous quantities, not perhaps to the highest of standard always, when competition came in from Southern Europe, Italy, Portugal, Spain, Mallorca, interestingly, they came. I remember my father coming home from the shoe factory in the 1970s, and he had a shoe by the OMW, took out this pair of shoes, and they were Spanish. And he said, they're better than we can make them, and they're cheaper than we can make them. And before very long, you know, a county and its towns that had been noisy with the sound of industry, everyone was employed in the fact they used to have a hooter that went off at 7:30 in the morning to get people to the factory. If you worked in Burton Latimer at Colesboot and you lived in Findon, you got off 10 minutes early for your dinner. So you'd go home at dinner time and have your... Lots of it was outwork as well, I should say. So the factories came along a bit later before that. Lots of outwork. So people would work at home. And I think that's kind of interesting because if you look at some of the those kind of heroes of labour in this part of the world, they were independently minded people. I think that's because they were working in their own back shop. So you go and you get your bits, you take it home. Famous in living memory in Findon, of the old boys have a little back shop at the back of their house, and women work in it too. And they'd have a whole load of tacks in their mouths and they would da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. So it was a sort of cottage industry. Mm. But all those people eventually started working in factories. And in the sort of 60s, you could be earning as much as £3.15 a week. Colesboot had a ladies' football club, as I said. Factory fortnight in Kettering. There for 2 weeks, everybody went to Hunstanton. It was a thing. And it was such a big thing that they used to print the Kettering Evening Telegraph in Hunstanton because everybody was there. And it was an extraordinary thing. And then all of a sudden, it kind of vanished. And I think like lots of post-industrial places, the towns of Northamptonshire have sometimes struggled to find a renewed existence. I have to say we're doing very well in lots of ways now. And there is actually a return of shoes. I mean, some prestige brands like Trickers, for example, here in Northampton, you'll still get handmade bespoke shoes there by appointment to the King and the late Queen. Shaquille O'Neal, do you know he had some shoes made there? Colesboot, can I tell you who came to Colesboot we made shoes for?
Nice.
Georgie Best.
Oh, well done.
Really?
I was so excited. I was 8 years old. It was 1970, and Georgie Best was coming to the factory to have his picture taken and get a pair of shoes. Didn't turn up. No
that
show.
That is disappointing.
Do you know who he got instead? Adam Faith. And there's a picture of all the ladies in the factory. And there was a lovely story about, I think it was at Trickers, they got orders from Elvis Presley for literally suede shoes. And all the ladies who worked in the factory, some of the chops in the factory were traditionally done by women, the closing room, for example. And they all put notes to Elvis saying, come and marry me and get me out of Northampton.
Do you have any of the Coles shoes? Have you got any?
I've got one pair left, which was made by Colesboot in the 1950s, were my father's gardening shoes in the end. But I've salvaged them and I use them. And they were very, I mean, they're Goodyear welted technology. They were pioneers of technology. I think it was the Blake machine was the first machine that sewed uppers to insoles and stuff. But then the Goodyear welt came along, with American invention actually, and made very robust pairs of shoes. I'm heading towards a favourite.
I was going to say, do you have a favourite fact
I
for us?
I do have a favourite fact. We were talking about how different towns were associated with different kinds of boots and shoes. Raunds was particularly associated with army boots. Huge, huge volumes of armies. But this caused a problem. The Boer War came along and Raunds made thousands and thousands of pairs of boots for the British Army involved not only in the Boer War, but in all its sort of colonial enterprises around the world. The Boer War finished in, was it 1902, 1903? I can't remember. And all of a sudden, they had loads of stock and nowhere to sell it. So that depressed the prices. And there was this enormous industrial sort of labour dispute that happened in Raunds because the factory owners, in order to keep going, started offering people poverty wages, basically. And that caused the strike. I think it was about 500 workers went out on strike. Well, there was a famous march to London to plead their cause. This is 1905. But there were, of course, strike breakers. And one particular notorious strike breaker in Raunds, well, actually, he lived in Ringstead, which is a village not very far from Raunds. And he would cycle in to Raunds, pick up his bits, take it back to his back shop and knock out boots. He was called George Roberts. And George Roberts decided that he wasn't going to give up his livelihood. He was going to continue to work through these hard times. And he was not going to be cowed by those who were insisting that the strike held. He had a hell of a time of it. His windows were broken. He was constantly threatened. At one point, he had to have 10 police constables escort him as he went to Raunds to pick up his pieces to take it home again. Anyway, the strike was over. But the interesting thing about Mr. George Roberts, the great strike breaker of the Raunds Labour, George Roberts had a cousin called Alf Roberts. Alf Roberts lived in Ringstead. It was a big shoemaking family. But Alf Roberts had poor eyesight, so he couldn't get a job in a shoe factory. He wasn't up to it. So he moved away, and he became a grocer in Grantham. And Alf Roberts had got married and he had two daughters, Muriel and Margaret. And Margaret Roberts eventually was a bright girl, went to grammar school, went off to Oxford, and she married a man called Dennis Thatcher. And she was Margaret Thatcher, who perhaps more than any other figure in our own chunk of history, did more to honour, if that's the word, the memory of her strike-breaking forebear, George Roberts.
Yeah. Excellent. It's a very good rabbit hole. Excellent. Not a rabbit hole I thought we would fall into, but there
that's
we go.
A good one.
So now, this is usually the part of the show where our disembodied voice declares the winner. But because we have you here, our live audience, we're going to ask you at the Royal Theatre to decide. So looking up behind on this big screen here, there is a code there that you can scan, or you can look at that link on your smartphone. And by doing so, that will tell you exactly how you can cast your vote. And because this is a bit of a special week, we also have something new, which is a winner's trophy that we have to show you. Here we go. Now,
no,
this is very
spare.
Special. No, but it is very special because it's custom made by one of our incredible listeners, Giles.
Can I just
made
hold
this.
It?
Yes, please
oh,
do.
Look
well,
at this.
Bit premature, but yes.
And we have named it, because it's a rabbit hole detective, we have named him
Warren.
And each week he'll be given to whoever wins it.
Yes, it's like we can take him home and look after Warren for a week. Don't kill Warren. That's basically the key. So,
in the old days, of course, you would have, if you'd stood for Parliament, you could have got all the people who worked on the Althorp estate to vote for you, couldn't you?
Yes, there's one of my ancestors who bribed people. There was a very close vote coming up, and so the kitchen staff were sent to the front gate to give people buns, and inside the bun was a shilling.
Really?
For their vote.
Did
yes.
it work?
It did. I mean, it was very expensive.
You're telling us this now? Obviously, as those of you who listen to the show know, we're not competitive at all, so it doesn't really matter in the slightest, does it?
I mean, it's just a number, isn't it? Or rather, just three numbers.
Okay. So I think we do now have the final... Yeah, we're all ready for that?
Yeah.
So the winner is... Richard.
Hooray!
Well done.
Got a bun with a pound coin in waiting for you out there. Thank you very much. So I'm the first winner of Warren.
Yes. You are. So you're going to have to look after him very carefully and bring him back to the studio.
I'm going to cherish Warren.
For a week.
No, I have to say, I don't have a massively stocked trophy cupboard, but Warren is going to take...
A mantelpiece,
pride
maybe.
Pride of pace.
Yeah.
Say, for a week, you don't think we get a new one every week?
No. But it does look very fragile, doesn't it? It doesn't look like we should really move it anywhere.
Yeah, I mean, it'd be awful if I left it on the train and then would have to have a new trophy.
We'll have to see, but well done.
Thank you very much. Well, I have to say, I mean, if you look at this in the round, of course, it's a... more complicated story, isn't it? A win tonight, but actually over the... We're now in season four, aren't we?
We are, yeah.
And I think, Charles, you're in the lead at the moment, but we're all...
All very
point,
close.
Well, we're about a point... You and I are a point apart, I think, aren't we?
It's amazing. We don't really care, as Richard said. We don't care.
No.
We are actually the three most spoiled, worst losing people you can meet. So these smiles are entirely false.
Just wait
I'm
we go
furious
out the back.
That Richard won.
Yeah. Slamming dressing room doors in a minute.
Yeah, there'll be lots of tantrums during this break.
I should say, you're putting me up tonight as well, so maybe I should be a little
bit... I was. You're now in the Ibis Hotel.
I was going to say, is the Saxon still open? Is the Saxon still open? Not for like 40 years. You know that the Codillon, the French shoemaker, was the first to invent... the difference between a left shoe and a right shoe.
Yes.
Mm. And that was actually true for production. That
yes.
was true. And it was in the 1850s that people, when they were... one of the technological developments in the boot and shoe trade in the 1850s was the developing of machines that would differentiate between left and right. Because before that, I know this sounds completely mad, but you just had one shoe. And
you had two.
No, Charles, you had one shoe and you had to sort of just hop
change
along.
It, change it over every step. Yeah.
But there you go. And it was called something like a cow bag. And you know those portraits of Henry VIII when he's wearing these very sort of like loose, baggy shoes. Or they were loose and baggy for a reason. They didn't differentiate between right and left.
The link to the Romans was that the Romans actually had left and right shoes before that.
But that wasn't mass production, no, I think. Yeah. Just,
but they had different shoes.
Well, you know, I don't know. I want to dispute that.
Good, yeah.
Just a thought.
We do need to do people who are listening at home or will be listening and only to know. And hopefully you too will want to tune in next week because we've got a new episode to record. So I've got to set you your homework. Richard, can you please go and research the accordion?
The accordion? You bet I can.
And Richard, Cirque du Soleil?
Or Charles.
Sorry. It's just, he just keeps winning, so more, you know.
Oh, that's a bit crushing.
Charles. Yeah, sorry. And I'm going to be looking at Amelia Earhart.
So we've got Amelia Earhart.
Yes.
Aviatrix.
Yes.
What do you do?
Cirque du Soleil.
Cirque du Soleil.
It's Airborne. Their 40th anniversary of...
Airborne Entertainment.
Yeah. Yes.
And over the accordion, which is an aerophone.
Ooh, well, there we are.
Very good link.
We've been thinking about how we can enrich our offer to live audiences. Those of you who've been following the podcast will know that Charles is a lifelong devoted Morris dancer. And it is my view, don't you think, that that would be good if... I'm not still happening tonight, folks, because I'd check the booth.
You can't do Morris dancing by yourself, I don't think. And I haven't done it for about 40 years. I did it with the Moulton Men or something. Yeah. Mummers. Yes, thank you.
I'm
not being rude. I'm not mocking
you. Well, you are.
I'm not mocking. I think you should. And of course, Kat was telling us about in Norway, it's the custom for grandmothers, mothers and daughters to make and preserve for each other traditional costume called bunad, which is particular to your own particular part of Norway.
Yeah.
And it's a big... So I want you to wear your bunad. With your Morris dancing, you in your bunad and me playing the accordion.
Yes.
What do you think?
Well, there's a...
I think
image.
On that bombshell.
Yes. So we will just have to tell everyone what at home what's going to happen as well. So that's the end of the live show. So thank you everyone who's listening on the podcast app and those of you here at the Royal Theatre. Thank you.